Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. The world of Native art has many players and great stories. Today we are turning to the pages of several art books that feature the words and work of a few Native artists that have really made an impact on both our tribal nations and the world at large. On this pre-recorded edition of Native America Calling, we'll hear about the work and inspiration of David Bradley, Kevin Redstar, and Lee Marmon. Join us for this look at Native art right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Spokane tribe has decided on a brand name for the tribe's casino project. As Steve Jackson reports, the name is likely to help the project if the casino gets approval from the governor's office.
The Spokane tribe has signed a letter of intent with HRHHIP LLC to use the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino brand name at their proposed casino. Tribal Chairman Rudy Pion says the highly recognizable name fits in well with Spokane's history as a gathering place.
In bringing Hard Rock to the area, to the Spokane metropolitan area, I think it's only going to add to the region's reputation as a main entertainment and regional shopping hub. You know, it's been that forever, you know, ever since, you know, Tribe Immemorial has been there. That's what Spokane was, Spokane Falls. For travelers, for fishing, for trading, you know, and the Spokanes have always been a part of that.
Pion says the facility will have a music theme like other Hard Rock establishments and feature a live music venue in addition to the casino and hotel. It's expected to bring 5,000 jobs to the region. The facility is still not a done deal as the entire project must still be approved by Washington Governor Jay Inslee. The casino received federal approval from the Interior Department on June the 15th. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Students and faculty at Central Wyoming College's film and TV program are forming a full-fledged production company this summer to make a show about the nearby Wind River Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports.
The show is a crime drama called Wind River that will be set and shot in and around Wyoming's only reservation. It will star some professional actors as well as locals. Amanda Nikoloff is a TV and communications professor at Central Wyoming College and the show's creator. She says she's been disappointed with how the Wind River Reservation is typically depicted in national media.
We hope that this project will give the people of the reservation a real sense of pride that this is our show, and we're going to show the nation that we are not a lawless land, that we are wonderful people full of culture and history.
The college is working closely with members of the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes to shoot a pilot episode of the show. Both tribes' languages will be included in the program. Nikoloff says there's been lots of buy-in from the community.
We're not Hollywood. We live here and we work here and we're neighbors. And this is not, and I'll be frank, this is not a bunch of white people that are going to make a show about the Native Americans. This is a collaboration of all of us.
Nikoloff says the project is also a chance to boost Wyoming's reputation as a filming location. Few things are shot here, and many of her students must leave the state to find work. Wind River is scheduled to begin shooting its pilot this month. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Schrank in Laramie.
The White House is hosting the first ever tribal youth gathering today in Washington, D.C. At the event, Native youth from across the country have the opportunity to interact with senior administration officials and the White House Council on Native American Affairs. The gathering is part of the president's Generation Indigenous Initiative to help improve the lives of Native youth. GenI was launched at the 2014 White House Tribal Nations Conference. Different national organizations are collaborating with the White House, including United National Indian Tribal Youth Group. Many Native youth will extend their time in D.C. through Tuesday for that organization's national conference, which includes a number of keynote speakers and interactive sessions. Topics include leadership, environment, culture, and health and wellness. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Supported by the American Indian Tourism Conference 2015, providing technical resources and education to advance and develop tourism programs in Indian Country. Early registration ends August 24th at AITC2015.com.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Tara Gatewood. Today we're celebrating Native art by connecting to three Native artists whose work has caught the attention of many people around the world, and for good reasons. Their styles have gifted several generations with a deeper look into Native culture. Some of the images that we'll hear more about in the next hour are giving a view into our Native identities, and just how they can differ depending on the individual. A couple of the artists that we are highlighting use their work to bring the viewer into traditional settings and introduce them to the people who make up their tribes. Another one of our artists featured on today's program uses color and form to really push the envelope and prompt people to rethink Native stereotypes. Today's show is pre-recorded and our phone lines are closed, so instead of reaching us by phone, we're welcoming your comments on social media. We're on Facebook and our Twitter handle is 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to start off with one Native artist who has Chippewa roots. Here's some of what Valerie Versu, a curator of collections at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe, or MIAC, had to say about the first artist that we're putting the spotlight on today.
I learned a lot about his personal history, and from that I can see how much that has really affected his work. And how who he is as a human being, formed by his history, has made him an artist. And the particular type of artist he is, whose paintings have a lot of personal elements, a lot of political elements in them.
Valerie is referring to Chippewa visual artist David Bradley. She had the honor and privilege of curating an exhibit of David's work at the museum titled Indian Country, The Art of David Bradley, which is open until January of 2016 at MIAC and features more than 30 of his iconic paintings as well as sculptures. Valerie also played a role in the exhibit's companion book, too. She added the words to help unlock some of David's story. Here's why Valerie feels more people should know about his work.
He really honestly represents what's going on in the world. He has brought Native American people into the modern world. They exist very much in the modern world. He is very much a student of history. In some of his most impactful works, he represents things that happened in history to Native Americans that up to this point are not represented from a Native American point of view.
If you ever wondered about the life of a Santa Fe Native artist, here's one view of what it's not, courtesy of David Bradley. He says some people's notion of Santa Fe Native artists is that they're debauchers, quote, living in a modern Sodom and Gomorrah, riding around in limousines, gobbling caviar, and licking the boots of every rich white tourist we can find. Now, let's go to Valerie again to hear more what it's really like and why New Mexico's city of Santa Fe pops up so much in his work.
He's really a painter of place, even though he is originally from Minneapolis. He has lived in Santa Fe for almost 40 years. He has married into Jemez Pueblo. His wife and son are both members of Jemez Pueblo here. So a lot of his work is centered around the culture of the Southwest and Santa Fe. He's a very political artist. You'll notice that a lot of his works have to do with the commercialization of Santa Fe. It's the city of Santa Fe. Commercialization and exploitation of Native American art, and he also works against stereotypes. He uses his work to change stereotypical visions of Native Americans in popular culture, in the art, and in the art world.
David is also known for how his artistic commentaries have a way of delving into politics and Native identity with a chuckle. Many of his works use humor to really hit things home. He says humor is a way to serve up a difficult topic in a more palatable way. David Bradley also says his art is deeply blended into his daily life and hopes that it speaks for itself and leaves the viewer with a clear message that Natives are still here. Here's MIAC Curator of Collections, Valerie Versu, again, on why the museum opened their doors to David's work.
We've always been interested in his work here, and we've shown his work with other artists in group shows. But we really thought that his work warranted a solo artist show because it's so powerful and so compelling to the general public. And it was really important for us to do it now because, as most people know, David Bradley has ALS. And he's probably, according to David, not going to be painting anymore. And his health, though, he's pretty much plateaued right now as far as his health. He doesn't seem to be getting any worse. But we just wanted to do something for him while he could really enjoy it and participate in the exhibit.
ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a terminal and progressive paralyzing illness. We invited David to join us on this program, but he was not able to for health reasons, but shared his words in an email interview. Referring to how he adds a Native touch to American iconic images, like Grant Wood's man and woman standing side by side image titled American Gothic, David wrote, "I don't hesitate to appropriate images from American art and rearrange them to make them mine or make them Indian. I write into the non-Indians' art world, and I count coup on them." Examples of this include his American Indian Gothic, which features Sitting Bull and a woman, and he does something similar in a second image titled American Indian Gothic, Tonto and the Lone Ranger Revisited, which you can guess by the title who the figures are that are standing side by side. David added, "America has always helped itself to whatever Indians have, our land, our history, our resources, and even our iconography and designs." Taking a stance on canvas is not the only place Bradley has used his voice to help expose social and cultural injustices. Concerns of Native identity fraud in the Native art world caused him, along with others, to take action and speak up. Valerie shared some details of how this came to be.
When he first started working in Santa Fe, there were a lot of non-Indians cashing in on Indian art by presenting themselves as Indian artists. And so throughout the 80s, he and other Native American artists in Santa Fe, as well as in other parts of the country, advocated for the passing of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, of 1990, which is really a Truth in Advertising Act, which means that if you're going to advertise somebody, your art or someone else's art as Indian, they really need to be recognized by a tribe or a community. So it's that was very much a very controversial thing at the time. A lot of artists and dealers turned against him, both Indian and non-Indian. So I would say that he probably considers that one of his greatest accomplishments was working on behalf of the Indian artists to pass this act.
David said the fraud in Native art in the 80s created a couple of problems, including counterfeits. He also shared saying you were Native made the art move. Even low-quality and mass-produced artwork, which he says led to a glut in the artwork. He added it may have caused some young artists of the time to lower their standards. Not only is his work with the 1990 Indian Arts and Crafts Act a fruit of his voice and artistic ability, so is influencing other Native artists. Valerie told us more about this.
I think he's really encouraged artists, Native American artists, to portray their culture, to not be afraid of making strong ethical and political statements in their work.
I also asked David what's more important, the art or the artist? He responded, the artwork. Not one for what he calls the showbiz end of the art profession, Bradley says the artwork should be the focus. He also wrote in our email interview that, quote, the artist is temporary, but the artwork is forever. I think that artists seek immortality through their work. We'd like to thank David Bradley for letting us into his artistic Native life to understand more about his art. And the name of the book that he and Valerie worked on is titled Indian Country, The Art of David Bradley. And we have a link to it and the MIAC exhibit on our website, which is NativeAmericaCalling.com. This is a reminder that today's program is pre-recorded, so our phone lines are closed. Instead of calling our toll-free number, we're inviting you to sit back and take in a few Native artist stories. Kevin Redstar is another Native artist that we were able to catch up with. He's also the subject of an art book that was put together by author Daniel Gibson and photographer Kitty Leakin. And it bears the artist's name, Kevin Redstar, Crow Indian Artist. There's a link to it on our website. We caught up with Kevin in June when he was on the road. Here's some of the energy that he shared with us when we connected with him.
Right now, my life is really exciting because I just took a trip to Santa Fe, New Mexico, my first trip with grandson down there for him to see Santa Fe and Taos Pueblo and just seeing the art scene in Santa Fe. He's so happy, and I'm so happy that we did that. That's one of the things that I'm enjoying right now. I'm able to do that now. And still, there's so much to see and do in this wonderful world. It is wonderful if you make it so.
Kevin said at first he wasn't sure where his art would take him. In the beginning, it was all about survival.
I just didn't paint because I needed money. I just painted just because I wanted to paint. You know, when I had my studio, I moved to Santa Fe and got a studio, and I'm saying, I didn't say, how am I going to pay my rent? I just started to paint. I just started to paint in the first couple of weeks when I moved there. I started selling my work because that was secondary. You know, my whole thought was creating wonderful things on canvas, on paper. And that's what I'm doing still. I guess I just have a positive attitude about my life.
Here's how Kevin described his style to us.
I guess I would consider my work, more impressionistic. You know, I keep saying my training is like you. When I first started out in high school, you know, we did setups. You know, you drew right in the studio. you drew some models and stuff. And my work, you know, then you go to museums, you know, then you copy, then you render images that you see in the museum collections. And then sometimes you feel that you've created or you're comfortable with a style. And for me, I've gone through so many different styles, and I really like the photorealism at, you know, as a start. When I was doing earlier sketches with tighter, detailed work, but then, you know, that got a little too easy for me. So then I started rendering, where I made it where certain images were exaggerated, and I like that. And then I gave it composition, like I said earlier, with different shading, cross, you know, hatching, and all this with this and holding it together. But I would, I guess, say my work would be on the impressionistic side, and I'm comfortable with that. There's so much leeway in that too, and I'm having fun with it. I'm playing with color, and I'm playing with size now also, but still exploring, you know, the crow people. There's just so much, you know, as old as I am now, I've been painting for the last 45 years, and I'm still portraying the crows. There's just so much to glean from, you know, from our culture.
And it's a beautiful culture. I've had the opportunity to be up in your area and you know, connect with folks there, and even the music, and man, laugh a lot. Kevin, you know, talking about your culture playing a big role in a lot of your images, can you describe to me the importance of color to your own culture?
Well, you know, I try to put festive colors in there, I guess. I enjoy going to powwows. I love going to feasts. And I see young people dancing with, you know, pretty costumes and young ladies. And I try to keep that alive in my work. And I've just seen so many negativity in this world and on that reservation. So I try to bring that back in any way I could. And so you see a lot of some of my work was kind of whimsical. You know, at first, when I first started out, I wanted to do that because, you know, like it's like you mentioned, a lot of us, these tribal groups, we use a lot of humor. We tell jokes, you know, we do humorous, you know, jokes on each other. But, you know, it's in a joking way, nothing serious, nothing to harm anyone. I think that's just the Indian way. That's a means of encouraging, I feel, and I was given that, and so I'm passing that on too, in a visual way. But for me, it plays a major role. I use a lot of exaggerated colors, and I've always been that way, and I've always enjoyed that. Something a little different, but acceptable to me.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling right here on your favorite radio spot. We're revisiting a conversation we had with Crow visual artist Kevin Redstar. Today we're learning more about Native art through the stories of several artists like Kevin. Our show is pre-recorded, so we're not taking calls. And now we're going to go back to this interview. Kevin, there are many images where it features Crow women in their traditional dress. Anything that you'd like to share for our listening audience as to why, you know, you put a lot of these characters or the representation of Native women in your work?
Well, you know, Crows, we're a matriarchal, you know, society, a group. You know, we depend on women. Because, you know, like some of these women are decision makers, and the Crow women are very respected in that way. You know, we got to realize, you know, the women move camp, make camp, you know, gather the firewood, you know, gather the kids together. You know, they're kind of like the camp. They take care of the village, and people tend to not kind of oversee that, not look at that. forget that. And I don't, you know. And matter of fact, I've got four sisters in my life, and I respect them all. And I lost two of my sisters, and they were both college graduates, and they majored in art. One is a writer, one was a writer, one was a sculptress. And they're just dynamic people. And I just the respect, not only for the cool women, but for the other tribal, women as well. But I try to put them in a regal way. It's like when they go prepare for a dance, I don't know how many hours it takes them, but when they're out there in their finery, they're just such a magnificent thing to see, and the beauty, the goodness in them. So I just portray that, and also some of the old style that I use, old style meaning the Thoughty dress, they're just handed down anymore because they're so precious and so few now. And so I like to bring that out, too. And so even some of the young people are curious about, what is this dress? Where did it come from? Why is this? Why are these little shells? They're not little shells. They're elk feet. And it has to be explained. And so I guess it's kind of something that I want to express and for the young people to see.
We appreciate you tuning in to our Native Arts Spotlight today. We're going to hear more about Kevin's work and one more artist in our second half. A look at what's coming up on the next program. On the next hour of Native America Calling, we'll give you something to help you get moving. It's an encore of our electrifying music mix. It will take us on a journey across Turtle Island and around the planet. Get ready to fill your ears and heart with dance, house electronica, and some dubstep by Native musicians. We'll be right back.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Right now, there's a Native artist who is creating. What they're putting on their canvas, carving into their stone, or even framing into their camera's viewfinder, the work they're producing may one day be the reason someone understands more about our Native cultures. Or maybe the reason why a Native artist decides to go deeper into Native art and make their statement. This space in Native creativity is vast and full of lots of life. That's why we've turned our hour over to the words of some of these artists. So far on this pre-recorded edition of Native America Calling, we've heard about the work and inspiration of Chippewa artist David Bradley and Crow Nation artist Kevin Red Star. And coming up later in the hour, we'll hear from Laguna Pueblo's Lee Marmon and his photography. If you tried to give us a ring to share your thoughts and got a busy signal, not to fret. Our phone lines are closed today on this pre-recorded program on Native art. When we pick things back up on our next live show, phone lines will be open. With that said, you can still leave your comments directly on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Before the break, we heard Crow visual artist Kevin Red Star share a little bit about his style and some of the images we see in his work. There's quite a balance to Kevin's work when it comes to the figures being represented. Earlier, he told us about how women play into his images. Now let's go back to Kevin's words to hear about the male figures.
Well, what I'm portraying now is, you know, you've never seen me do any warrior-type figures. You know, like all of us Plains Indians people, not only Plains, but the other tribal groups in the country and in Alaska, we weren't all warriors, but we were just protectors. We protected our land. We protected our village. We protected, our food sources. And that's just basically what it was. But when they see somebody intruding to our land, you know, we encourage them to leave. If they don't, you know, we just... We do a little bit more than that, but, you know, other non-Native people, when they see that, they think they're all just bloodthirsty savages. They don't know what they're doing. All they know is just, you know, creating, you know, some negative, you know, energy to everybody that's about. That's not the case at all. No, but actually, you know, that is not the case of our existence as, you know, as Native peoples. But I think I want to portray the male as like once again, you know, an elder. He needs to be respected in whatever the garments that he wears. If he's a war bonnet is worn because it's, you know, each feather is earned, and it, not just anyone just can wear a bonnet or even a one eagle feather. That one particular feather needs to be earned, and earning that. You need to have a witness also. And so your fellow man or your fellow warrior or your hunting party member or you're going on a campaign against a foe, if you're caught at coup, you put somebody down or embarrass the enemy, your fellow warrior needs to see that. So he can say, yes, such and such did actually do this deed, so he is deserving of this feather or two or something equivalent. And that's how they're earned. It's just not something you just pick up and just put in your hair. But things like that, I portray that. And the young people also. I do a lot of young people, young boys and girls, and with their horses, riding horseback, bareback, because all of us all grew up with and around horses, like myself. I grew up with horses. Like I was on a horseback since about 5, 6, 7 years old. And that is quite memorable. And you're bound with a horse. Horse has a spirit. Horse is a living thing, and we respect it. And if you're with horses long enough, sometimes, I got to tell you, sometimes it's better to be with a horse than some people sometimes. But I'd like to portray that, you know, the fondness of horses with young people. And they, in that way, they grow in love and respect a living thing. And I like to portray things like that in my works.
And Kevin, I see also a lot of images of teepees. Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, that's once again, that's I'm bringing out, you know, the village and the people's home, where they live. You know, maybe the setting might be, you know, a winter setting, fall setting, spring or summer setting. But, you know, home is, we all need a home. And I like to portray that in different settings, in different angles, different shots, evening with stars, or a snowy night. But I love teepees.
Early in his art life, Kevin took educational steps to help his skills really take flight.
I needed the training, you know, and the knowledge and the tools. And so the Institute of American Indian Arts at the time, you know, I had some really super teachers, you know, with Alan Hauser as my painting and drawing instructor, and Lloyd New as our 3D, three-dimensional, you know, artist instructor. And our music instructor was Lewis Ballard, and boy, you know, it was, you know, what really fascinated me, what really kept my interest was the fact that I was, you know, being taught by a Native American professional artist. And I think that's what really kept my interest. You know, being from the reservation, you know, we go to either a mission school or I was from a private school, you know, private township on the reservation. And we didn't have any, our teachers were not Native people. So that was hard on a lot of us young people when we first got into elementary. And let alone elementary, junior high, and high school. But when I transferred from Lodge Grass to Santa Fe, that's what I was exposed to, you know, a new art world that was dynamic with the best teachers I could ever imagine.
And you named quite some big names there of people who were at your side, you know, instructing you. Can you share any words that they shared with you about, you know, just being a Native artist or the importance of getting your own Native voice out there? Anything like that you can share with us?
Well, the thing is, like I was saying, you know, like just the fascinating aspect of the whole, you know, experience was having, you know, these Indian artists teaching, you know, young teenagers like myself and, you know, the people that were the other young students that were there at the time. You know, that was, you know, dynamic in itself. But what they were trying to do is, if I had potential, naturally we had potential because that's why we were selected to go to this really fine little experimental school at the time. And we were given the tools, the proper instruction, you know, the good environment, the best environment, you know. And so we excelled. We really excelled. And I think that's what a lot of us just needed, that encouragement, you know, and just guidance that was just so needed for us. And what we did, too, was I had this really fine and fun, you know, teacher. He was an Irishman named James McGrath. He was the arts director at the time, and he really encouraged a lot of us. He's a poet also, a painter, once again. But he encouraged me to rediscover myself as a Crow Indian. Okay, we know you're from the reservation, but let's dig into it and let's just see what is a Crow like? You know, what is our design elements? You know, and compare that with the Sioux, the Cheyenne, you know, the Comanche, and the pottery designs from the Southwest, and the basket designs from the West Coast, and the carvings from you know, the Alaskan islands and Northwest coast, and you know, it took me about a 6 months or so. I did a lot of comparisons, you know, with the Crow Desire and the elements and the history and legends. So we compared a lot of that. And even that, you know, that encouragement from that man really opened my eyes. I never considered doing that because I just, I'm Crow, so there it is. I'm living a Crow. That's who I am. But it was good to do those, getting in there and understanding these design elements.
The Absaloga, or Crow Nation, where Kevin's from, is located in south-central Montana. Overall, Kevin says he loves what he does and has been doing it since he could remember, even back to when he was drawing as a little boy. Some time back, Kevin's work caught the eye of publisher Gibbs Smith, and that eventually led to the book that many are turning to learn more about Kevin. It's by Daniel Gibson and Kitty Leakin. Here's more on how this project came to be.
When I was approached by Daniel Gibson, and his wife, Kitty, the photographer, Kitty Leakin, they're both out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. We sat down and had lunch one day in Santa Fe, and they were saying that this one fine publisher named Gibbs Smith out of Salt Lake City, Utah, was quite interested in doing a profile on me. I guess the reason was the fact that when he took a trip to the West, Northwest here in Montana, and he stopped at the Crow Reservation, and he was just, his parents asked about, you know, the artists in that area, in the Crow region, the Crow Reservation, and my name came up, and I guess they saw some of my images. Well, I don't know how that came about, you know, they seeing the images, because I was just still starting out in the early 60s. But I guess it just goes that when Gibb went back about 20 years later, he was in the publishing business, and he went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he visited the Institute of American Indian Arts and spoke to one of the professors, the instructors over there, and he asked about me because I guess my name kept popping up in his life, Smith's life. And so then he got really curious about me. So then he started reading, some of the articles that I was in when I was a young student in Santa Fe during the early 60s. And I guess that's where it kind of all started, you know, with his research and his love for, you know, Native American art. And my name kept coming up. And so he decided that he kind of just started following me. And in the meantime, I have a web page, and he saw that, and then the people that he kept running across, my name would keep coming up, and so that got him really curious.
A link to Kevin Red Star's art book is on our website. If you just tuned in, you have joined us on a special pre-recorded edition of Native America Calling. Although our phone lines are closed, our Facebook and Twitter are wide open. And if you'd like to tell us about a Native artist that you admire, feel free to send us a tweet or post on our Facebook. Our final visit today is with a Native photographer who calls New Mexico home these days, Laguna Pueblo, to be exact. And he even has a road named after him in his community. I'm talking about Lee Marmon. Lee's images have been enjoyed by audiences around the world. It was our honor to connect with him from his home in his village to learn more about why he's lived a life as a photographer. He said his camera has given him a gift.
Well, it's given me an insight into the pueblos, you know, the old-timers. And I got a chance to talk to a lot of the old-timers. They trusted me because I was here. I don't think they would let anybody else take their picture. And I strive to do the normal, you know, just as they were. And that's what most people say, you know, your work is good, but it's a good thing that you got the pictures as the people were. They didn't change. There's only one or two that I can recall, and I don't blame them. There's one of a lady that was up on the ladder plastering, And I asked her about it. I happened to be driving by, and I asked her about a picture. And, of course, she had mud up to her elbows, and she had a scarf over her head. And she said, next Wednesday. And I said, okay. And so I the next Wednesday I went, she was all decked out and looked really good.
You're connected to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we just heard from Lee Marmon, a Laguna Pueblo photographer. A lot of Lee's work can be found in a new book by him and Tom Corbett. It's titled Laguna Pueblo, A Photographic History, and it's off of the University of New Mexico Press. Share your thoughts with us today, and do it through your tweets. Our Twitter handle is 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go back to the discussion I had with Lee about his photos this June. Lee, can you tell me about an image that you feel really changed your life?
Oh, sure. That's the white man's moccasin. Old Jeff, you've seen the poster, I think.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one that... And on that same roll, I got the two little girls at the clothesline. And that became a very... So on one roll of film, I got two great pictures.
And what was going on that day when you got both of those images?
Well, actually, I was up in the village delivering groceries. That was my job then, in an old Model A pickup. And I was walking across the plaza, and Jeff was sitting over in the corner, and I was carrying groceries. But I took a detour and went over to him. Since I had my camera in the car, in the truck, I said to Jeff, how about a picture? And he said, no picture. And we talked a little bit, and then I left. But when I got through delivering all the groceries, I went back and gave him that cigar. And he let me take, I think, two or three pictures. And that's how I got that famous one. It clicked into, it was, I guess, perfect time.
I'll say. He looks really, really comfortable. He doesn't look like somebody who didn't want their picture taken. Did he ever get a chance to talk with you after, you know, that picture started picking up speed and getting out there to the world?
Not really. I would have liked to talk to him, but I think about that time I left for California to photograph the Bob Hope Desert Classic. I was on and off 8 years to Palm Springs and back. And the one thing I'm really sorry about is I would have liked his high tops. His daughter had them for several years, and then she threw them away. And that would have been great. they were U.S. kids. And no, I had known him before, but we didn't do a lot of, you know, talking together.
And what color were they?
Oh, they were regular old basketball shoes, black, with U.S. kids on them.
Nice. And what would you say, Lee, that photograph represents?
Well, I represent we call it the white man's moccasins. That's about showing that the tennis shoes took the place of the moccasins. And I don't know whether that, I wouldn't call that progress, but that's the way it worked.
And I know a lot of generations have stepped in that style of shoe. You know, some of the first gym shoes that grandparents also, or great-grandparents, stepped into. But, you know, every time I look at that image, Lee, I can relate to it. And it almost feels like it just happened recently. Does that ever fascinate you where sometimes, you know, a photo can be old, but it feels like it just happened recently?
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I look at that all the time and wonder, you know. And I have some others that I took in other places that, you know, the changes that came, excuse me, about on the reservation or in the past few years are enormous. Of course, I was born in, excuse me, 1925, when there was no doctors, no hospital, no nothing. And now we're into an area where there's cell phones and dish TV and all of that. It seems a little strange, but I went through the 1930s, you know, the Dust Bowl and the Depression, and then the 40s in the Army and the war.
Lee, when you think about all the times you stood in front of folks and took photos or either looking out on the landscape, anything you want to share about, you know, just composing those pictures or knowing you have the right frame or that you're even standing in the right place? Tell me about that.
Well, that's an odd thing, because strangely enough, right after I got out, excuse me, you know, I got the technical end of the camera. My eye was pretty good to frame pictures, and I cropped them pretty well, and then I printed them, and I'm down to the last two or three boxes now, and there's some that I printed 40 years ago, I guess, and they're getting pretty rare. And I did get some, you know, dances on the plaza, and my composition seemed to be just right. I don't know where I learned that. I guess I learned that by remembering, you know, you got to compose the picture. So, yeah, I took pictures of Eisenhower and Nixon and Ford and Reagan and all of those. And so most people kind of wonder, well, how did you go from Laguna Pueblo to Palm Springs? And it's a long story, but that was it. And I never had any formal training in photography or sketching or anything, but I guess it just kind of fell into place. I don't know. And it seems like it went by so fast. It's enormous pressure to think back at what you should have done and didn't do and all of that. But, you know, I just quit taking pictures last year, the year before, which I'll be 90 in this coming September. And I hope I reach 90, because they promised me a nice birthday party.
And a really big cake, because you need a big cake to put that many candles on.
Yeah. And I tell people just for fun, I said, we're looking for a girl to jump out of the cake.
And Lee, I'd just like to go ahead and wrap up with just asking you, is there anything you want to leave us with about the impact photography has had on your life?
Well, it's had a lot of impact on my life. I learned so much by being a photographer, not only just about photography, but about the people and how fine they were. The old-timers were extremely nice, gentle. We never had any problem, and I got along with them very well. and just shows that there's one community where everybody was pulling for everybody else, and really, really nice a company. My dad had a trading post, and I worked with him for 20 years, so I knew quite a few of the people, and they trusted me. You know, even from the northern pueblos, I took some pictures, and one of the ladies said to me, she would get, you know, there were a lot of photographers after to take her picture, and she said she just froze when they were around. But when I was around, she was very relaxed because she knew me, and all the people trusted me. So I think that's the reason I got a lot of the good pictures, because they trusted my judgment as to taking them.
That's going to do it for today for this pre-recorded edition of Native America Calling. Links to all the books that led us to today's discussion can be found on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Thank you to Laguna Pueblo photographer Lee Marmon, Crow visual artist Kevin Redstar, and Chippewa artist David Bradley for sharing their words with us. Also thanks to these artists and their book publishers, authors, and photographers for sharing these artists' images with us. You can find a photo album on our website of all the creativity that you heard about on today's program. Also thanks to our engineer, Stephen Emmons, for editing this program. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood.
This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peace, CORPS.gov.
The Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma features Choctaw-made merchandise online at ChoctawStore.com. You can own a piece of Choctaw culture delivered to your door, whether it's the works of Choctaw artists, unique apparel, accessories for your home or office, music, videos, and books, including the Choctaw language books. You can find it at ChoctawStore.com. Labor Day delivery available for orders placed on ChoctawStore.com by August 30th. ChoctawStore.com is proud to support Native Voice One.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.